Reading through the work of Isaac Newton from around 1600 and forward onto the work of Einstein, the real base concept in science is momentum. And he dealt mostly with the momentum and later told you how to calculate momentum. And Einstein, again, the conservation of momentum is a very important concept. It's only when we're teaching it that we tend to focus on the actual starting points of measuring the mass and the velocity, that those things come first and then momentum comes afterwards. So there's a sort of reverse in the way it was thought of and its importance in science and the way it's thought of, but we actually teach it in the reverse. So this is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. Rehabilitating, as you've heard before, from a heart operation, hopefully improving my podcast and improving physically. One of the strange things is there's, for all the documentations and the brochures, there's actually no workplace rehabilitation to get you back into work. So it's really left for you to figure it out. Oh, look, it's not happening. Let's start working on it yourself. And from a research background, I've sort of looked at the technical points, what I can and can reasonably do, how to get the technical aspects of podcasting done, and how to actually produce something that I can look at over time and see how I can improve, and some get feedbacks from people overseas and work with teachers and do the basic things that you normally do with rehab. So that's what I'm afterwards. And this particular podcast is to do with momentum, some basic insights about what the importance of people's first experiences. And you can give some very common everyday examples, but how to actually deconstruct that into something which is really, really precise. one of the things is that students will no doubt learn the basics first of measuring mass with a pair of scales or electronic scales. They'll should, I suppose, try and impress upon them the difference between balance scales, which compare mass forces and therefore measure mass, a comparative force, or electronic scales, which measure a force, a gravitational force on a mass. So we'll read out a calibrated mass in kilograms, and to learn to report things in kilograms. Similarly, the importance of measuring recording speed and velocity. So velocity is speed with the direction, and again the units of velocity meters per second, and that is m/s, or in modern numbers. Okay, and believe it or not, we have progressed from ms to the minus one, which is a small m, a small s, and a little superscript minus one to represent reciprocal. Now, in year seven, that's going to be difficult because they may not have been exposed to the minus one, but by year 10, majority of students will be exposed to that. The important thing is that education is sort of out of step with, I suppose, science. It's sort of not a big issue. Basically, you start publishing and you just look up the Science Style Guide. The Science Style Guide says, I think it's NIST, they've given a basic style guide, and you see reporting. So what has changed now is that MS, the minus one, can mean two things. Used to be ambiguous. MS could be milliseconds to the minus ones, because small m is a milli and s is the same thing. Or it could mean meters times seconds to the minus one, which we actually mean. So rather then leaving it up to the context, we have introduced the midpoint term. So we'll get into the the canonical momentum experiment to run with kids and how that should be set up. But this time it's meters per second or ms midpoint s. Sorry, m midpoint s. Or mid dot, I think it's called. If you look it up on the computer, mid dot. So this is not a full stop; it's a mid height dot, an s, the minus one, a small minus one, and I don't know. There's various issues. So this is the absolute units, the idea that a number in units corresponds to a physical quantity, whereas a number by itself without units is just a ratio that corresponds to a measurable quantity which goes in. While we're at it, in modern science we've dropped the comma, so saying rather than 12,000, it would not be 12,000,030, so it would be 12 semi-space, so rather than a full space as between words, there's a semi-space between the 12 and the several zeros there, although that's really unnecessary with scientific notation. Which we'll go into in a second. So practically, the mid-space is you go and for this space between numbers, select a much smaller font size that will get something correct. Now, often people will miss the scientific notation, and if you don't have a lot of influence in your faculty, people, and you come back and you correct an exam or a test, there'll be, we don't do that type of stuff here. But this is just an advice for people to be made aware of that the science has moved on. I don't know, 2007, around that time, we swapped over and clarified scientific notation. Just to go back, there's a few flies in the ointments, things where, you know, practicality meant that we couldn't apply general rules. We'll get on to momentum, sure, I'll tell you. But litres are a capital L, so millilitres is M capital L, or metre litres would be M mid dot capital L. So L is one unit that is in capitals, whereas kilograms is a small kg, or gram is in a small g. That's one aspect. Another aspect is where there's some ambiguity, where we use two different units. There'd be in general we use a capital letter for four, I suppose, units. You've got the coulomb, which is capital C, and for degrees Celsius, you have the degree and the C together. That's an exception. Kelvins. There's a few examples of that. I'll be scratching my head to think of too many. But there's a few odd examples to know. It's like learning any language. There's rules, minimal rules, which are fairly easy to follow, and a few exceptions about writing scientific numbers. And this is for kilograms and for meters. And the basic take-home message is that science, or SI science, we work with kilograms, meters, and seconds. Yeah, I was going to say, there's some interesting thing. I might do another podcast on the kilogram, where I've had to say goodbye to my favourite. The Big K in Paris is been cut loose, but we'll go back. So that's interesting that the K and various units can go out then. So we're going back to momentum. Momentum of an object is the mass times the velocity. That's the A definition of momentum. It has a symbol of a small p, and to describe momentum of a chair at midday would be p subscript chair subscript midday, or subscript. So in terms of writing up things, we use the subscript as what we would use in long form English as a small word written smallly underneath the symbol. So the symbol is it is sort of object oriented, but it is object oriented quantities, and we say the quantity for the object, and then start to specify that object down. So very much scientific writing goes very much into the object oriented programming of C++ and all that type of stuff. So teaching students how to write scientific notation correctly is a good thing for teaching them C programming or programming object oriented stuff, so you can keep on putting it through. So P subscript 1 or subscript I, depending how you want to do it, that would tell you the momentum of object number 1 initial. So I and F is a good way of saying before and after. You can put a B and an A if you really want to, but I and F is the standard things. Now this is in with odds to SUVAT, SUVAT, where they've got a U and a V for the same concept. That does not. So U is the initial, V is the final velocity. So two different symbols for the same concept is no longer good scientific notation. So it will be V subscript I equals V subscript F. Now there is actually a practical problem in schools in terms of you do have vision problems in your class where people have poor vision and can't tell that, you know, U and V is easier to distinguish than V subscript I subscript F. But in general, if you can assign colours as well as to it, again, that's a difficult thing to remember, but makes it good, because you've got to have here we've got the P, which is P one initial is M one initial times V one initial. Rather than saying subscript, I'm just, you know, that if I say a word after an adjective, it's after the other. So it's a bit like French that I know of, and this is cringe. Thankfully, very few French people listen to this. So Moulin Rouge means the windmill red. So the French are already a bit ahead of us. We tend to put the adjectives before. So although we do say initial velocity, but it's actually velocity initial, V subscript I. We have to actually give the basic formula P equals MV, but practically what we mean is that P subscript 1 subscript 2 equals M subscript 1 subscript 2 V subscript 1, subscript 2, that the actual momentum at a point in time for a particular object is equal to P, and so P is a sort of a compound concept, even though, as I introduced, it was the original thing that people focused on, because that had to be conserved, and so they deconstructed it. So it's sort of like, this is the thing that we can take away, but if you look inside, it's got these two components. So you want to have experience for the students, which is as is authentic, but as close to the formula that you're going to teach and take away. You can have the generalized concept of momentum, but if you have a generalized concept of momentum, they can remember that with caveats of it not working as well. So I'm going to describe an experiment, and so for this you'll need some wooden trolleys with blocks with light wheels on it, and so these are kinematic carts, they're called, but the ones that I'm going to describe to you is something that you take to your woodworkshop and you make it yourself. So you have a basic square block, and in that block you place three holes that can be cleaned through it along the long axis of your block. So you have four wheels, three axial holes, and there is a face which is cut away so you can see it. When you actually listen to what's going on, you'll be able to put it all together. So the idea is that these two kinematic blocks, collisions are imperfect. Collisions are imperfect, and so we have to. So a collision normally involves three components, and this is something that you eventually will have to tell the students. There's the loss of momentum of the individual components coming together, deformation, and then acceleration again. So there's deceleration, momentum, deformation, and then expanding. So even a simple thing of a ball bouncing, which is very simple, it's got three components. It's got acceleration into the ground, the slowing down, the instantaneous slowing down and squishing, and then the rebuilding of it. And so even then, the way the paths through those three sections can determine what sort of collisions and what sort of how momentum is conserved, and you can get students very, very confused very, very quickly. So we have these three blocks, and unfortunately I can't describe it to you too quickly, I'm going to have to let you, because it's a podcast, I'm going to let you have the momentum. So what we're going to try to do is just get that third part of a collision going, in which momentum is definitely conserved. So even just dropping a ball has too much going on to deconstruct in a way that students can follow. Trust me. And so the ideal thing to do is have these trolleys. And you have to organize these trolleys in the second part of the collision. They want to push away from each other. Now, there's several ways to push away. The best, sort of the premium way of pushing away is having little neodymium magnets, which are placed equally in, say you've got three holes, through hole number one, number two is through the middle, number three is closer to the other axle. So this is going at 90 degrees to the axles up the guts of your little mini dynamic trolley that you're making up. Sort of the larger dynamic trolleys are just horrendous. I don't know why. These heavy blocks of wood, and it's just danger and disaster. So if you've got a heavy block of wood and a bench, that's a heavy block of wood which will go and hit a student on the foot after falling a metre. And we're not living in a robust age. It's something you have to worry about. So I've got these little boxes, a bit bigger than the size of a large box of matches. How do I describe it? So the premium quality one is with neodymium magnets. They cost, you can get them for fairly good, powerful neodymium magnets for down the shops. You can buy them for $2 from in bulk in China, which you really should buy. It's about 65 cents each. You can buy a whole bulk of it from, typically it will be eBay or something called Mr. Magnet or the Magic or something. There'll be something like that in your country. So as you get the idea, we've got two trolleys. Obviously, you want to get a bit of a class set going, so this is why small blocks, because if you build something big, it takes up a huge storage volume. Something small, it's good. And these blocks can be arranged with the little wheels on it. And you have four sets of neodymium magnets, and one way they pull together, another way they repel apart. Now, obviously, you want to get the repel apart section, and what we want to do is have these pushed so they're repel apart. So you can either use neodymium magnets, or you can use which you glue in. So you get button magnets, and you have everything of the right size, and you glue them in. Again, I'll have to tell you possibly a bit about... let's assume you can glue them in. okay. You may want to cover it with felt or pop them in properly. Pop them in. You can actually build this completely out of resin. I won't tell you how to do that one. Okay, so you can either have neodymium magnets or springs, and the springs you have to build and put in, and you can position your spring or position a spring inside your component component there, so have a screw down to position your spring. The spring has to be at the end of the day much smaller than your hole, and you have something which pushes against the spring. The issue I suppose with the spring is a certain amount of maintenance, and when they go into the boxes, the springs stick out and various stuff like that. I've had some good success and some poor success en masse. Lots of springs can get. Neodymium magnets are by far the best. These are the little button super magnets. You've got this thing which you're holding together. And essentially what you want to do is actually have this such that you can hold them together. Now, the most successful method of holding it together, which is far more successful than the big heavy kinematics trolleys, is we now have three holes. One hole, a central hole, which will go right through the axis of it. And if you can arrange it such that you can, with dental floss in a figure eight. So what happens is that you thread your dental floss through the central hole, over the top, back through again, twice through the centre, and then underneath, and then tie off again. So if you look in cross section, your dental floss is in a figure eight, and then you have the trolleys held together in a clamp while you're doing this process, and then you tie it off to and at this process, before you've started this, you've measured the mass of trolley one and trolley two, which you can vary by attaching various things to it, and vary and record it. Sometimes I won't go into it. On the trolleys, you also need a felt inked collision pad. I'll keep on going on to it. While you need the inked felt collision pad, this is simply because nowadays getting carbon paper for your impact point is too hard. And if you have a sort of a felt, you can have it attached to it inside a felt pen if you want. So the felt pen, although that will tend to knobble it, or a pencil sticking out. So you can begin to get the idea. So you have a hole drilled such you have access to see the central strings. I prefer getting it from the side. There's sort of a natural safety aspect to it, and you can actually undo cut, or as I recommend, burn the central pieces of dental floss. The reason I say dental floss is that it's got basically it's light. It goes through quickly. It does burn through quickly, and it's not stretchy. So what happens is that it will give you a clean break when you want to. You insert into there not a soldering iron, but a wand with nichrome wire. It's getting, it sounds complicated, but it's not, nichrome wire. And you can actually just have, rather than something complicated, a 9-volt battery and a little piece of nichrome wire if you want to. You can have a flame if you're desperately interested in it. Students tend to light that one, you know, where they just light a match and place it underneath it or beneath it, and this will explosively release your trolleys. Now this is the point that you've broken up your collision. You're doing the final part of the collision, and you're doing a momentum conservation part of the collision, and you have a short run of a few centimetres on either side before they career down and hit the ground. And the time of flight, if it's there, the time in the air is equal. And so the distance moved, this is parabolic flight, this is again physics, but you don't have to sell that. You therefore get the distance being extremely equal, and what happens is that for a particular impact, you can just note the impact and draw a ruler line between the two impacts, and repeat this several times. Rotate, you know, have a heavier and light going, same weights. That's a very obvious thing to do. But heavy and light going left and right, then right and left. Through this process, they get quite excited by it. And measure the distance here. And now, there's nothing like high-quality data and a simple explanation. And when things start to not work the way that they want to in these collisions, they start to properly deconstruct it. There's nothing worse than you understanding it and then guiding the class to an understanding of it. So in this experiment, they were butcher's papers on the ground. They'll have the impact point. Now, it is important that impact point where it hits is sufficiently high. It's going sufficiently slow so that when it impacts the trolley is going down at over 45 degrees if you really want it. Now there's a sophistication that the actual distance should be measured not from the point where the two trolleys stick together, but from the point where the pencil is or whatever it is sticking out doing it. And there's different variations, so I'm sure that you can think of something better. But as an engineer looking into this, it's taken a bit of time, and in my present school I haven't had the resources to do it, but it's a much more effective way of doing it. There's a variation of it you do with the older trolleys, which are sort of like brick-like trolleys. They weigh a kilogram or more, so they're hard to measure. They're large. There's a spring you place in them, a spring and plunger, and you have to actually release the catch on the spring. It fires the plunger out, and you measure the distance that these two trolleys of different masses push away from each other, and that's a thing that produces results at a time. It's it takes a larger amount of the classroom, so people have more difficulty walking around seeing the demonstrations and collecting data, and they, in general, they collect a very large amount of data with this technique, especially if you have one lesson where they get used to it, and a second lesson where they actually produce it. And there's a second, more advanced lesson of spherical impact ones, which I'll go into in another podcast. So this is Peter Hill Explains, where as part of my cardiac rehabilitation, I'm doing my own rehabilitation at this point in time, practicing talking into podcasts, and I hope this has been sufficiently clear. It's rather a challenge to have a concept and an apparatus and a lesson and try and stitch it all together. This is definitely not for students. This is for teachers to listen to and see if they can pick it up, and in general have a go at building it. Then replay this podcast, and you'll have a fantastic high-precision lesson. The students will walk away with a very precise understanding of momentum and conservation of momentum, rather than real-world examples which have this complexity in which you have to step in and explain. And then you also have the basis of starting to talk about the three zones of an impact. Again, that's not really covered in the textbooks, but it's a very necessary thing, and especially if you can show impacts, a tennis ball or a basketball going in slow motion, you'll be able to see it, and then after that you should be able to cover some more exciting basic momentum experiments. So, look, I really hope that you do it, and the rest of the world starts doing good introductory momentum experiments. And at the end of the day, it's closer to the insights of Newton and Einstein about momentum. Thanks for listening.